I'm doing this one because our topic, which everybody knows now, we're finally coming to the crescendo of the age of the universe. So, if you recall from when we started, by the way, I want you to know, when I did this at MMI, they told me to stop talking and they wanted to hear the song. You guys are okay if you keep talking. They said it politely. What were the words of that song? What were the words? Anyone familiar with Eitan Katz? Alright, let's try it again. One second. There's more. Maybe you'll like this better. They like that. So you guys will like this. Who said that? Excellent. How on earth did you get? How important is tefillah is Adon Olam?
Very important.
Unbelievably important. There are some that say it is the yesod of all tefillah. In fact, it's not coincidental. Start off in the morning, Adon Olam. What's the last? Who says Kriyat Shema Lamita? That's it. Kriyat Shema Lamita. The last thing, Adon Olam. You start your day with Adon Olam, you end your day with Adon Olam. Why is it so important? Second hand out. See if everyone needs one, let me know. Alright, so enough music? Yeah?
Wait.
You get it, right?
You never heard enough music yet.
No, it's true. Actually, I believe that.
Is that a different song than last
time? So, everyone, they didn't like the fast one, they wanted the slow one, whatever. Great girl. Now, what's so special about Adon Olam, and what does it have to do with this topic and the theory of relativity and everything we're about to do? What's so important is Adon Olam is an incredible microcosm of what it means to be a Jew. What does it mean to be an enthusiastic Jew? Why? Listen to the words. Adon Olam Hashem Alach Matarim Kol Yitzir Nigra Le'es Nas'a Bechetzal Kol Azayim Melech Shemo Nigra Be'achare Kichos Kol Le'vedo Yimloch Nora. What three words are there? Hashem Malach, Hashem Melech, Hashem Yimloch. Right? The first six lines, Hu Ayavu Oveh, Hu Yiyeh B'sifara, Hu Echad Ein Sheni, Lam Shilo Lachbira, Lireishis, Blisachlis. What is this being Meta'er? What is the first six lines of Adon Olam describing?
Past, present, and future. His only God, his only God.
Right. And the Malchus of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the incredible, awe-inspiring awesomeness. Like, what does that mean exactly? Who Ayah Oved Yiyeh? What does that mean? It's beyond our comprehension what God is. The first six lines of Adon Olam are all about the awesomeness of God, the Malchus. Now, what's the most important word about Adon Olam?
Adon.
What's the difference between an Adon and a Melech? What is the what's the implication?
One is a king.
Yes. King, how do we relate to the king? The king's distant. The king is like, I'm in awe of the king. I'm in fear of the king. That's Malchus. That's the first six lines. All that incredible stuff about what God is and his essence and just incredibly awe-inspiring. It just makes me scared. But the second half, listen to the second half of Adon Olam. What does that mean? You know what it means? Anyone? Stretch. What happens when you go to sleep? What happens to your neshama?
Goes up to
Shammai. It's not a joke. Right? Remember, the neshama has three components. We learned about this a long time ago. Right? There's nefesh atzamachas, nefesh achius, that's your biological neshama. It keeps your heart beating, your blood circulating, your breathing, your love. Again. But then there's the chelik elokai mimal, the neshama that makes you special, that makes you a Jew, that makes you a special human being. That goes up when you go to sleep. So that's why, you know, your pulse is still going when you're sleeping. But biyado afkid ruchi, my neshama goes up to God. I give it to God as a pikadon. What's a pikadon?
Collateral.
Right. Okay, collateral. Well, throughout Shas, we use the expression pikadon. What does it mean? You give the pikadon to a shomer, to watch. It's an object that you're giving over to someone to watch for you, preferably somebody you trust, right? Because he's going to do a good job, watch over it. That's what's going on with the neshama. We give it up to Hashem. Why? Because there's a transition in Adon Olam that's unbelievable. What would be the value to me, or what would it mean to be a Jew whose only way of relating to God is the first six lines? It would not be a very, very pleasant relationship. It would be not the real relationship that we're supposed to have. Who is the greatest original Jew? Avram Avinu. So who knows the Gemara Brachos and Daf Zayin? What does the Gemara Brachos and Daf Zayin say? What was one of the greatest, most laudable achievements of Avraham? He's the first to use what expression? Adon. Before Avraham, there were other biblical characters. They used Malchus. They spoke about Hashem Melech because there was some awe out there. They were afraid. That's the way they related to God. Fear. Comes along Avraham. What was the big chap of Avraham? What makes him so special? One element that makes him so special, Chazal pointing out,
my master,
Adon, personal relationship. It's not only that God's this distant, just scary being, Hayahu Veviyya, that was here before everything's going to be here forever, created everything, and if he willed it, everything would be gone. That's scary. It's more than that. It's who Keli the Chai Goali. He's my God, he's my personal God. We have a relationship. At tough times, I go to him. I bitachon bo, but surachavli be'es tzara. He is my nisi. What is nisi? Vahu nisi. What does that word mean? It's a very, very important one. Nisi is a banner, like a flag. What's the significance of a flag when people go out to battle? Right? Anyone ever see a movie where they're losing the battle, and then these guys, you know, practically give up their lives to get that flag up, because the flag's going down. Why is it important to get the flag up, the banner up?
To show that you conquered.
Right? But it's also to strengthen and hearten what usually happens. So here's what usually happens. Right? They're losing the battle. The generic movie, war movie, right? They're losing, at least when they have flags, right? So the battle's being lost. Some idiots look like they're giving up their life to save the flag. You're wondering why these idiots giving up their lives to save the flag? They get the flag up, suddenly the whole battle turns around because they're invigorated and they're strengthened, right? Hunisi means he's my banner when I need confidence building and strength building, when I need to be uplifted, he's like it. Adon Olam captures what it means to be a Jew. What it means to be a Jew is to have these two things going simultaneously. Yiras Hashem and personal Amas Hashem. That's what it means to be a Jew. So it has a lot of relevance to what we're about to do, because we opened up the topic of the age of the universe, focused on what? Focused on the fact that this is a dangerous topic. Why are we necessarily doing such things? Is it mutter to study such things? Isn't this going to be developing chasronos in my emunah? Isn't this going to destroy me as a Jew if I start dabbling in these kind of things? How could it be that it's mutter? Remember that whole discussion, the Rambam land, your college, why you? Right? Is it mutter to study these things and explore them? So we determined, yeah, it's worth it. Why don't we? It's worth it because we want Yiras Avas Hashem. And the root to it is if we could successfully really understand Hashem, right? The more we know Him, the more we love Him. That's what the Rambam tells me. The root to Avas Hashem and Yira is get to know Him, right? Like the analogy I love to use is like a true, and this went over really well in MMY, I don't know how it's going to go here. It's like marriage, right? It's like a good female-male relationship, right? How do you fall in love? Would you like to volunteer to answer that question? We'll let you off the hook, right? How does a person fall in love? What is love? They love, suddenly they're like sleeping about the age of the universe, Einstein, no interest. I started talking about love, and like it was great, right? So what is the key to love between a man and a woman? Yediyah, that's true love. Everything else is superficial. You know, it's not going to last. You get to know the person, that's where love will come from. And that's not, you know, lahavdil, but that's what the Rambam's telling me, begade HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kivyachol. The more we can get to know him. What we're about to do is, through the reason it was worth the risk of this issue, is because I believe, as the Rambam tells me, Yediyas Maaseh Breishis is a key towards greater Yediyas Hashem and love of Hashem. Right? Some people would say, right, that all the Rambam really wants is the Yediyah part, right? But, nevertheless, we're going to move past that. We're going to try to get greater understanding of Maaseh Breishis, and through that, just a glimpse into the incredible greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I couldn't help but say that we should introduce everything we're about to do like that. So we had this problem. Let's quickly review and then get into the final ultimate solutions that are out there. Admittedly, these that we're going to do today are my preferred answers. The ones that we did are there. They're available to those who like them. They're not my preferred answers. The kasha is, science has very conclusively demonstrated that the age of the universe is 13.67 million years old by many methods. On the other hand, Seder Olam, Chazal tell me it's 5,774 years old. What do we do? Conflict. So we've seen some answers. We saw first the Lubavitch Rebbe's response. What this one I know, Shmuel Weisberg loves. What does the Lubavitch Rebbe say? He says, well, you know what happened? Hashem created the world to look like it's that age, but it's really not. 5,774 years ago, Hashem created this world to look like it was 13.67 billion years old, and that's the solution. Can anyone disprove that? No, that's an absolute winner in a way. There's no way to disprove it. Maybe it's true. What was the dissatisfying part of it, though?
Why?
Right? So I told you a little bit about Dessler and a little bit of what Schwab says to try to answer that out of that. Bechira, nevertheless, it's all possible, but not necessarily the favorite answer. So then we said, okay, what did the other guys say? What are my least favorite answer?
The marble.
Right? Who said the marble? Hold off on the marble. So the least favorite answer was, they said, you know what, let's just not take the Torah literally, right? Oh, the other alternative that wasn't good is the scientists are wrong, right? That could be true. It's a very dangerous approach to take, right? Because as they get more and more evidence that they're right, then what do you do with that kind of approach? The third approach was really what many say, which is don't take the 6 days of Bereishis as literal 24-hour periods, right? It doesn't mean day like we say day, right? There wasn't even a sun up in the sky till the fourth day. All it means is, the Torah is euphemistically, or not euphemistically, but as an analogy using the word day, but it means several billion years, right? So that's another approach, could be right. What's unappealing about this? Goes against the majority of Chazal. It's apologetic. It's after the fact. Where is this answer offered by Chazal themselves? So not so great. But I wanted to give you a taste of the non-apologetic side. So what we ended with last time was the Baalei Kabbalah. What did the Baalei Kabbalah do? They presented to us, you know what? Science is right. Those ages of billions and billions of years were in the Kabbalistic literature 1,000 years ago, well before it was any challenge to any Jewish person. There were many sources, if you have that handout, I only spoke about one, but there were several sources that discussed how this is the way Chazal, Baalei Kabbalah, understood it themselves many, many, many years before any other secular person knew of such an idea. So that's pretty comforting. But it opens up the challenge for today, which is, so how can both these things be right? Pashut Pshat in the Psukim is there were 7 days. 6 days of creation. On the seventh day, Hashem
rested.
I just see if you're awake. Yes, rested. Which leads to?
Shabbos.
Got a little help. So how can it be that it's 7 days and at the same time billions of years? How do we have both those things working together? So I want you to see there's going to be two, we're going to look at two responses to this that actually show both are right. You can have your cake and eat it too. We're going to show both could be right. The first approach is by Rav Shimon Schwab. Rav Shimon Schwab is an amazing, amazing person. One of the real tremendous Talmud Chacham, the Posek, everything, just amazing person, but one of the most creative thinkers out there as well. He handles some of the toughest challenges. Like, for example, one we haven't done, but may do one day. For those that are familiar with it, there's 165 years missing from history. Right? Anyone ever hear of this problem? Right? The secular dating and all dating is off by 165 years. Rosh Schwab comes up with a really brilliant solution to that one. But that's for another time. For today, he looks at the following three makoros and comes up with an incredibly creative response. So, which handout is everybody looking at? So, everybody turning the page from this is the thing we did for Adon Olam. There's that Rambam again. Okay? I'm on Medrash Rabbah. He looks at Medrash Rabbah and he says the following. It says in Bereishis, Gimel Zayin, Amar Yochanan Bar Simon, Yehi Erev Ein Gzidkan Ela Vayehi Erev Mikan Shaya Seder Zmadim Kodin Lachem. What's the upshot of this Medrash? What's this Medrash say? He's saying, what does it say after every day of creation in Sefer Bereishis? Vayehi Erev Vayeboker Yom Echad Sheni, etc., etc., right? What are they jumping on? The Vav. What's with the Vav? What's the implication of the Vav? Like, I would have thought, when did time begin? The first day. But Vayehi implies the Vav. No, there was a Seder Zmanim that even preceded. There was some Seder Zmanim that was present. What does the Seder Zmanim mean? A means of telling time. There was a time modality. A divine clock. If you like that kind of analogy, right? That existed before even Shesh Yisimei Bereishis. So what's that referring to? So hold the thought for a second. Go to the next page. Medrash number 2. Vayikra Elokim la'or yom, lohu or v'lohu yom. It's maha. So he's saying, it says, Vayikra Elokim la'or yom. So or and yom, right, are not equivalent, the Medrash is saying. Or is not yom, and yom is not or. So it's strange. Tani ora shenivras b'sheisis yimei breishis lahayir b'yom, eina yecholah shehi mak'e gilgal ha-shemesh, u'balayla eina yecholah shelo nivras lahayir ila b'yom. There's this original light, vayihi or, it says in breishis, right? What is that light? Is that light from the sun? No, when does the sun start providing light? Day 4. So what's this vayihi? What's the or? So, truthfully, the Big Bang people can give you a nice theory as to exactly, right? I think Zach's grandfather was really getting into it last week. He told me his theory on associating certain cosmological realities that occurred on physics perspective with this vayihi or, which is very nice. But what this medrash is saying, hey, what happened to that or? God created a light, and it's not there anymore. And this light, what did this light do, by the way? When it was present, it was day. When it was absent, it was night. So that's not how night and day work. How did night and day work as far as we know? Right? What happens? There's a sun. The earth rotates around its axis. That's day and night. So what's this thing? It's something totally different. What happened to it? So that's what the Medrash asks. What does the Medrash say? Very famous. It's ganuz la tzadikim la asid lava. Right? But one wonders, hey, that light is what was determining night and day. In addition to, from the fourth day and onward, the earth's rotation around its axis was determining night and day. So we got two clocks for night and day. We got the original divine clock. This is all Pashup Shad in the Medrash. Pashup Shad in the Psukim, if you ask me. Right? You have day determined by the original, by Yehior. And then we have day and night determined conventionally the way we understand it. One more bit of medrash that Rav Schwab uses from Sanhedrin. The next page. Amar of Acha Me'ekra de'agma Amar of Yochanan Bar Chanina Shtem Esrei Shas Hayo Bayom. There are 12 hours in a day. Sharishona Hutzbar Afara. The first hour, God collected the Afar he was going to use to create whom? Adam Arishon. The second hour, he made the golem. What's the golem? What's a golem? It's like a formed but lifeless being, right? The glob, the blob. He formed the golem. He made the body of Adam. Shlishis nimtachu ivarav. Right? It wasn't just a blob anymore. He fashioned the limbs. Revius Nizraka bo neshama. There it is. Oh, that neshama, right, gets tossed in. V'chelik elokai mimam. Chamishis amar al ragrom. Adam gets up. Shishis karashemos. In the sixth hour, he names all the animals in the entire world. In the seventh, he gets together with Chava. Literally. Shminis alu lamita. They go up to the bed. Right? How many? Shnayim. Biyardu, how many came down? Four. Whoa! Not a bad way to have a pregnancy, right? You go up in two kids. Right? This was Cain and his twin. What's happening? What's going on? An hour. Less than an hour. That part was less than an hour. Don't ask me how long. Right? Okay. Cheese. Nitztava shlo lecho mina ilan. The ninth hour, he was commanded not to eat from the trees. Right? Which tree? It's a chayim. Asiris? Srach. What does that mean? Srach?
Sin.
Yes. He sinned. What did he do? He ate. All this is happening within the first 12 hours. Something strange here. Achas asar nidon. He was judged on it. Shteim asrei nitrad v'halachlo. Thrown out of the garden. The entire second parak of Bereishis taking place in 12 hours. Now, what on earth is going on?
When was Hevel born?
Later.
Later. After the sin?
Right, so, interesting. Not necessarily, but not at the time of the two going up to the four. So, in truth, a lot more is going on during these 12 hours, which is part of the confusion here. He was born separately. It was kind of his twin, then Hevel and his twin. Yeah. But later, right? Either, and it was after. It was after. But still, what's going on? So much is happening in such a short span of time. Comes along with Schwab, and it's all detailed in English on the next page, but I'll summarize it outside. He comes up with the most incredible explanation to answer our problem. And it's founded in these Makoros. That's important, because he's sticking to Makoros. He absolutely refuses to say that the days were not 24-hour periods. But he says like this, the reality is, when God created the universe, he had two clocks going. He had the clock of Vayihi, or the divine clock. It was there and then gone over how much time? 24 hours. Because Yom Echad was 24 hours, Yom Sheni, Shlishi, even before the sun was up, they were 24-hour periods. What determined the beginning and the ending of the 24-hour period? The appearance and disappearance of that light. So that light is coming and going every 24 hours, right? 12 and 12, let's say. Not necessarily. I don't know if it like had seasonal changes. But let's simplify it. The light is there. It's called it's called Yom. The light is not there. It's called Erev. This light is not our understanding of night and day, but it is a 24-hour divine clock. It's still going on right now. It never, ever went away. It was created by God. When will it come out and appear itself again? Olam haba for the tzaddikim. But it existed in reality, and it still exists. Simultaneously, there's another clock, our clock. The clock that's determined, a day is determined by one rotation of the earth around its axis. Says Rav Schwab, he says, right now, our earth's axis circulation is in complete sync with the divine clock. It takes 24 hours for the earth to go around its axis, night and day cycle, is identical to the divine clock. Since when is that true? Since Adam HaRishon. Since Adam HaRishon's time, everything's in sync. What was going on before then? What was going on during the 6 days of creation? Says Rav Schwab, the divine clock was going every 24 hours. But you know what was going on Earth? It was rotating millions and millions and millions of rotations at the same time as 24 hours were passing. So that all, this is the way he explains it, all of physical, biological processes that are going on were accelerated during the time of creation. So, there's no problem with the fact that the earth is billions of years old because it has billions of years worth of biological and physical activity that are going on. Just imagine that we're all used to a certain standard of rate of all that we experience, right? So, for example, what do you think your heartbeat is? How fast does your heart go? All right. So, you're healthy? Good shape? Really good shape? Great shape? Improve it? No. I would say your heart rate is probably, I'll take your word for it, if you're in good shape, somewhere between 50 and 70 beats per minute. Right? Good? How fast do your eyes blink? How fast does your brain work? How fast can you run? How fast can you move? How fast do cars move? All of it, you have like a Newtonian sense of, right? You know, like, there's certain things relative to each other, how fast they go. That's what the world reality is right now. How fast is the Earth moving around its orbit in the solar system? Any idea? Anyone?
Speed.
Very fast. We don't feel it, but we're all moving very fast. This is going to be important for Plutka Mishamot Vodam. Is anything really Munach? The Earth right now is moving tens of thousands of miles per hour. We think that we're standing still.
Only
right?
The sun's also moving.
Oh, wait, we're getting there. We're getting there. So it certainly, I'm sure it is. Right? The whole galaxy is moving. Of course, there's a big bang. The whole universe is expanding at incredible speeds, as a matter of fact. And the further away it goes, like, faster. But anyway, let's not get into all the physics. Let's just stick with this. So what is Rav getting at? Imagine all those rates that we're talking about, just multiply them by 10 billion. That's what was going on during Sheshit Yimei Bereishis. So he now gets his cake and eats it too. He doesn't have necessarily scientific proof of this. But the Midrashim, he plays off of. He says, look, you have already, things started to slow down with the birth of Adam. So, you know, you could like get together with a woman and have children all within a half hour. That's pretty good, right? It's not quite 10 billion times the rate of the way things work now, but that's pretty good. 9 months, 20 minutes is pretty good. So he says that's the message of that Midrash. Is that that's what's going on. And that 7 days mean 7 days. That was a 24-hour period. However, the activity of the Earth and all biological and physical processes were rapid enough so that when you look with our clock now, we measure it to be 13 billion years old. That's Rav Schwab. Okay. What's the strength or weakness of this approach?
Science had to have changed. We only observe it at the rate. It would have been
interesting. Right, so does any scientists you know have any experiments that delve into the Sheshit Yimei Bereishis?
No.
No, so he knows he's got pretty safe. You know, no one's going to disprove him scientifically, right? So, but what else is a weakness? Well, he has a little bit of Makaris, but not, I don't know, not quite the type of Makaris I would want. Now, if he had, you know, something, he does give me a medrash that for some reason implies things were moving very fast back then, but not quite on the rates that he's saying. But otherwise, it's an interesting approach that I think some people find appealing. The one that really takes the cake is the next one. This is Schroeder, right? Who has seen Schroeder or read Schroeder themselves? Anybody? So, the problem most people have with Schroeder, I love Schroeder stuff. Now, he's criticized for two reasons. One, people don't understand him, right? So that's one thing. It's not everyone has access to what he's saying. He, even though he starts by saying you don't need to like science or know science to appreciate what I'm about to say, it's really not true. Because like the most significant chat that he has, it would really help if you could just understand Einstein's theory of relativity. It would be very helpful, right? So we're going to try to do that right now. The second critique we're going to get to, and that is what's really important to if a guy like Schroeder, and let me just summarize what he's going to do. He's going to take the most advanced scientific theories now and show how they are going to resolve our whole problem. So what would you want before you say, hey, this is my man? What would you want to happen?
Prove that it's right.
Well, I would want independent, real experts to assess what he's saying. Like, I don't know enough. He's an MIT genius in certain areas of physics, right? He definitely is. He could say whatever he wants to say. I'm not astute enough, I'm not trained enough in physics to say, is this guy know what he's talking about? Is he saying the truth? He's just pulling one on me, right? But I want my independent experts to assess his work. If they say what he's saying is true, I'm in, right? So I'm going to show you what happened with that, because that was a major controversy. A whole bunch of real cosmologists came in. assessed what he had to say. They criticized it, but we'll see what they liked and what they didn't like. So first, let's understand it. So everybody see the front page? We're about to learn the theory of relativity. All right? Who here hates science and especially physics? Raise your hand. I want to make note that only about 5 people raised their hand at this point. We're going to try. I purposely picked a book. See this book? Now, very few people in the world really understand the theory of relativity. So I went to the library, and when I was getting into this, you know, I don't remember when it was years ago, but when I was first getting into it, I said, I want the idiot's book of the theory of relativity, you know, if such a thing exists. And lo and behold, it did. And I found it, so we're in good shape. Cartoons, right? Nothing's better than cartoons. So the first page is really all about, it was just for historical interest. This is not going to help you understand the theory of relativity. But anyone who can appreciate this, what was great about Einstein? Why is Einstein thought of as such a special guy? Like that he stands out amongst all the scientists, like he's the man? Because he did the following. He spent 10 years thinking about a problem. 10 years thinking about the following problem, right? What bothered him? What bothered him is that everybody knows, let's say you have a mirror and you're looking at your face in the mirror. What allows you to see your face in the mirror? Anybody know? Yes, exactly. It's the light reflecting off your face into the mirror, right? So in order for this to work, right, ideally the mirror is stationary, your face is stationary, and the light beam goes right into the mirror. How fast does it go? You better get this right. The speed of light, right? Good. Comes along Einstein, and it starts that, and I guess he was bored. He worked in a patent office, which is like giving patents, and he's probably bored out of his mind, so he's standing around, and I don't know what, he didn't have like anything, you know, like any device to play with. So he's, you see, it's probably good to do away with the devices, then you can come up with the theory of relativity. He's standing up there and he's thinking, hey, what if I was on a rocket ship flying at the speed of light myself? I'm like, zzz, and I'm flying at the speed of light and I hold the mirror up, right? And the mirror is moving away at the speed of light. What should happen? Will there be a reflection? So Einstein said, you know, it can't be. The light from my face will never catch up to the mirror. So there'll be no reflection. But he said, that can't be. So that was his problem. So don't think about it too much because you're never going to understand it. But I just wanted you to see something about what perseverance is. So for 10 years, he was grappling with this. My God, wow. You know, some of us would say get a life. Do something else. But he's doing it. So then, at 10 years, it hits him. And he just changed the world. When he got his idea, when he understood what was going on, it changed the way everybody who knows anything understands our world. Everything that had been understood for centuries before that, let's say from the times of Newton, was out the window. It's only Newtonian physics is practical, but not the truth. The truth is Einstein. So remember that. This is been proven experimentally and accepted by everyone that Einstein's got it. What Einstein says is true. So I want you to know that's why this is really going to be something Yemos HaMashiach type of material. Because in Yemos HaMashiach is when we're going to really understand what's going on. Einstein is one major clue towards that end. So let's try a little better to understand it. The next 2 pages are my attempt at conveying the idea of time dilation, right? Anyone who heard that expression, time dilation? Okay, at least Zach. What's time dilation? It's very, very important. And you cannot talk, I'll tell you right now, you cannot be an intelligent person talking about the age of the universe, the finis deity, unless you understand time dilation. If you don't, you don't have it. And you have no right to say a word about Chazal. Because Chazal, we're holding in time dilation. Maybe. At least the Bali Kabbalah were. So let's try to understand it. Everybody see the train? You don't have to compliment my drawings. There is the train. Now on this train, which is a 50-mile long train. Now, bear with me, right? The reason I made it 50 miles, I wanted the math to be simple, right? So we have this train that the length of it is 50, I wrote big train, 50 miles long. Now, here's the guy, who's a good pitcher?
Ash.
Okay. Some pitcher is standing over here at this end of the train. He throws the ball to the catcher over there, 50 miles away. How fast is he throwing it? How fast can he throw it? We'll find out in a minute. Right? At the same time, the train itself is moving 100 miles per hour. Good? So now let's say I tell you that he's throwing the ball 50 miles an hour. Right? It takes him an hour. Right? Standing over there, there's my catcher over there at the 50 miles down the road. He's got a pretty good arm. He throws it 50 miles an hour. That's not such a good arm, I know. But it's pretty far to throw it 50 miles. He throws it 50 miles, right? So, to the catcher and the pitcher, how fast does that pitch go? It's not hard. This part's easy. 50 miles an hour, right? Everyone knows speed equals, right? Velocity equals distance over time, right? So the speed is the distance, 50 miles in 1 hour, 50 miles per hour. That's easy. Now, the train is moving 100 miles an hour. Is that affecting the speed of that ball to the people on the train?
No.
Not at all. But there's a guy at the train, like, off the train, a stationary observer, who's at the train station or he's on the ground outside the train. He's watching all of this, right? Happen. He's looking. You see the little guy with the hat?
He's up on his back.
Right. Isn't that nice? He's just like, you know, innocently shooting the breeze. He's watching these guys. He's watching that ball go, right? The train's going 100 miles an hour. How fast is the ball going to him?
150.
It looks like it's going 150, right? So the speed of the ball is, what's the word?
Relative.
Relative, right? His theory of? Relativity. Right? We'll see where we're going with this, right? The speed of the ball to, the guy on the train is 50 miles an hour. The speed to the guy stationary is going to be 50 plus 100, 150. Okay, that seems to be nice. Everything's great. Not such a big deal. In other words, if I had a radar gun and I was the catcher, 50 miles an hour. If I was the stationary observer, how fast would that ball register on the radar gun? 150. Easy math. Now turn over to the next scenario. All right, now we got to move it up a notch. Rocket ship. We have our guy with a flashlight. So he shines a light. Now, how far away? There's a measuring device at the end of the spaceship. How big is the spaceship? A light year. How large is a light year? I have it written over there. 3 times 10 to the 8th times 365 is pretty big, right? That's gigantic, right? That's a light year, but I need it for my math, right? So it's a light year away. He throws it. How long does it take? He doesn't throw it. He shines the light. The light travels to that measuring device. How fast is it going?
Speed of light.
It takes a light year to get there, right? Because what does a light year mean, by the way? Should have said that. What does a light year mean? The distance light travels in a year. That's a light year. So he shined the light. A year later, it hits the device, right? Very patient people, right? And boom, one light. Excellent. Just so happens, the spaceship is traveling half the speed of light. And now we have our stationary observer. See the guy with the antenna? You like that? Right? Some Martian is on the side. He's watching the spaceship go by. The spaceship is going half the speed of light. So, remember what we said about our capture of baseball? How fast is the light traveling to that Martian? 1.5 times the speed of light. Wrong. That is absolutely impossible. There is nothing faster than the speed of light. You can't. There's a law of simultaneity. We don't have to get into the physics. I want this to be for laymen. But I'm telling you, take my word for it. Absolutely, the max is the speed of light. What's going on? How can we make this work? Right? We have a problem here. We have a problem here. I mean, okay, granted, I don't really have a spaceship doing this, but trust me, this has been experimentally proven, what I'm about to tell you. The speed of light must remain the speed of light. So, I have my guy over here looking at all this happen, and it looks to him, right, it should be going 1.5 times the speed of light, but I'm telling you that's not possible, it's only going the speed of light. Something has to give. Something has to give, right? Because the distance traveled is going to be much different for him than for the guy on the spaceship. The guy in the spaceship, it's definitely going to travel 1 light year. The guy over there is definitely going to be traveling more than that. It's going to travel 1.5 light years. But the speed stays the same. If the speed stays the same and the distance increases, what must happen? What else is in the variables? Let's write this out. Right? Velocity equals distance over time. This is the same as the speed of light. This is greater. What must happen to this? It must be less. Time? Time can change. But it's happening at the very same moment. These two guys are observing it exactly at the same time. My guy's standing here. My other guy's standing there. The light hits that device exactly the same time. How could there be a different time flow when everything's happening at the same time? That's time dilation. What it means is, and this was Einstein's discovery, and all you need to do is get a feel for it. You're not going to really, you know, be ma'ayin and understand it to its fullest depth. I'm telling you, it's amazing, and it's entirely true. But what Einstein realized is the answer to all these dilemmas is that time itself is relative to the place, speed, and gravity of the place you are in. In other words, the flow of time is a very hard thing to really stomach, right? The flow of time is changing. I'll give you some examples that I'll maybe bring it home. It's very hard to understand. There are two theories of relativity. There's the general and the special, right? So one relates to velocity. That's what we've been doing. That's much harder to work with. Let's do the easy one, gravity. Larger gravitational forces slow the flow of time. Take a look at the next page. That'll help. On the bottom. If you didn't understand the word I said, don't worry. Just understand this. There's that big planet and Earth. This much you need to understand. Gravitational force is determined by mass. The greater the mass, the greater the gravitational force. Gravitational force will affect the flow of time. What does that mean? It means the following. 3 minutes will pass on the big planet while 2 years pass on little Earth at the same time. Because your reference is what's going to determine the flow of time. How time flows is determined by where exactly you are and how these forces are operating. So that if I was on Earth and I could see from my reference frame and look into that big planet, it's going to be looking like things are moving very slowly over there, right? 2 years are passing where I live, while 3 minutes are passing over there, and vice versa. If there was a guy on that planet able to see me, he'd be seeing things moving incredibly fast, like Rav Schwab described, as a matter of fact. Why is all this important? Because comes along Schroeder, and I'll say this outside, it's all detailed, I give you the key paragraphs in there. He says, what's going on at the time of the Big Bang? What's going on over there? So, well, there's two reference frames. There's the reference frame from Earth, ultimately Adam, and there's the reference frame of the Creator, God. Now, who's the only one who counts prior to the birth of Adam? God. What does God's reference frame take into account? The mass of the entire universe. Right? God's created the universe. His reference frame will take into account the entire mass of the universe. The mass of the universe will create an incredible gravitational pull. It will have an incredible effect on the flow of time. From the reference point of God, time is flowing at a certain rate. From the reference point of a person on Earth, it's a much different rate. Everything's happening at the same time, but time is flowing differently. Now, is any of this pure hypothesis and not proven? No. This part is accepted. This part, Schroeder is going to ultimately say, 7 days, 24 hours, seven 24-hour periods, that's what's passing from one reference frame, from God's reference frame. Time is moving much slower, but from the reference frame of people, it's billions of years. This is his incredibly clever way of telling me something that Lefinius Daiti, a person who's serious, must contend with if they're going to start talking about the age of the universe. You have to say from what reference frame? Because time is relative, and time flows differently depending on where you're coming from. And from God's perspective, it's flowing at one rate. And from man's perspective, it's flowing from a different rate. Now, where Schroeder went wrong is... The universe has mass. The entire universe is mass. And it's...
If things are turning faster or faster, we have less gravity, right? Less mass.
The reference frame of Earth is less than the reference frame of the entire universe. Correct.
So that means God...
Everybody goes by the entire universe.
Everybody goes by the entire universe?
God is everywhere. He goes...
In other words...
How is time going slower for him?
Right, because what's creating the flow of time is the mass of the entire universe. Why is that incorrect?
Isn't that saying that God is beholden to the physical universe?
Doesn't it hold like self-finality to God?
I have no idea. I mean, I have no idea what you're asking exactly by saying that. But in other words, God wrote the Torah, and God described that there was 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, and there's a physical earth. Does that do what you're saying? In other words, because God relates to a physical earth, you're telling me that limits him? Because that's no different than what I'm saying. In other words, God relates to he's relating to me. Dibra Torah b'lashon bnei Adam, he's describing something to me, right? From his perspective. And from his perspective, time's flowing like that. From my perspective, it's flowing differently. That's all Schroeder's saying. Huh? You're asking me
mass,
to explain
right?
Einstein's theory?
No, according
no.
to
the more mass you have, the slower time.
The more mass there is, the greater the gravitational pull, and that will affect the flow of time.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah.
So
it all depends on the perspective.
Mass.
It has nothing to do with God. God's the observer. God's the observer outside. God's the observer.
He's somewhere where there's a lot of mass.
Why don't we assume that God is...
Well, right, okay, I got it. I understand what you're asking. Good question. I understand what you're asking. It's sort of like this. God's above time and above space. Absolutely. However, he's communicating to me, Dibra Torah B'Lashon Bnei Adam, only within the parameters of time and space. I can't understand things from God's true perspective. Right? But from the perspective of a person, let's say, who's looking at the entire universe, time would flow as this. From the perspective of a person who's limited to being on Earth, time flows like this. That's really the idea. You're right. It's not like Hashem standing there somewhere in the mass of the entire universe, the planet universe. No, but it's...
One billions of the Earth, and that's where we are, right? And then the other one was 24 hours.
Simultaneously, from one perspective. Now, let me ask you this. Is there... Yeah. It's not saying that God has time or God's limited by time or anything like that.
So where do you have the 24-hour cycle? Not
our time.
No, from our perspective... No, from our perspective, it's billions of years.
Okay.
From our perspective, time flew. In other words, like we said before, let's say the little planet and the big planet. And by the way, this, all the Nobel Prize winning physicists say, there are definitely planets or there is places in the universe that you will have a time dilation factor in the millions and billions of factors. So that there will be one planet will be differing from another one by many, many millions and billions of years. That they totally agree with. Now, so from the perspective of somebody simultaneously experiencing something, right? Shishis may brachis. So from one reference frame, 24 times 6 hours have passed. And from another reference frame, right? You don't like it to be gods. Okay, that's kind of cute. That's the way Schroeder presents it. But you're right, you don't have to say that. But from an entirely different reference frame, let's say a reference frame that represents the velocity of the exploding Big Bang universe. That's also going to affect time. There's going to be many things affecting time dilation. The ultimate point is like this. Schroeder made a big mistake, and this is what he got roasted for. He took this to a very, very dramatic book-selling degree. What did he do? He made a formula, right? If you look on page 3, that's where it is. This is where I think he really ran into trouble. He estimated the mass of the universe to be 10 to the 55th power grams, figured out a radius, derived the whole formula, and showed how it's 15 billion years versus exactly 6 days. And he gets all excited and he says, oh, it's unnerving and it's amazing, right? But he got ripped apart. Why? Because it's stupid, right? First of all these other physicists said, who says the universe is a sphere? And there's all these other very strong contentions with his whole mob. But what all of them, this is the key words for me, turn to page 3 and 4.
Wouldn't that talk be relevant to right now?
Huh?
That calculation would be relevant to right now.
Say it again?
That calculation inside the universe.
The calculation is nonsense. The whole thing, after reading the critique by people that know what they're talking about, not me, I'm a cardiologist. We don't know much about cosmology. But I listen to what the experts have to say. People that are neutral, unbiased, but experts in their field. So it's like this guy, Barry Simon. Barry Simon rips Schroeder. That's on this page over here, critique. And the first thing he says, his whole model for the universe is incorrect. So, I believe him because I don't know who's right, but Schroeder has to go on the defense. And he defends himself, but I didn't think that strong a defense. Right? But what Barry Simon acknowledges, and the next guy, the next critique coming up later is somebody else, actually before it, it's on the page before it, right? Lee Spetner on page 2. What they seem to acknowledge, even though they don't like the details of his thing, is that you cannot discuss the issue of the age of the universe without putting in relativity as a relevant parameter, as a relevant factor. Whether you're going to be as dramatic as Schroeder and start talking about, yes, he talks about God being outside his reference frame is standing outside the universe. So not only do you have the problem of what you guys are saying, but a bigger problem is so he's not in the universe. Right? God's only outside the universe. He's not like filling the universe. We don't believe God's right here, right now. Right? What else does it mean to give God a location? Right? Makom means ain lo makom, right? There is no makom, there is no time, there is no place. Ein achinami, right? But when you're going to talk about the age of something, right? And you're going to talk about how we can measure the passage of time, you must take into account that in the early universe, there was incredible velocities going on, incredible dense, high gravitational pulls, and relativity becomes relevant. The way, we'll end with this, Dr. Spetner puts it, is as follows. Schroeder's account pauses at several places to explain some basic physical concepts. Radioactive half-life, the wave-particle duality of light, special relativistic time dilation, the thing we've been talking about. His explanations are clear and correct, and he supplies references for his more important scientific statements. He attributes the disparity of timescales to relativistic time dilation. He notes that according to Einstein's general theory of relativity, time's rate of flow depends on the intensity of the local gravitational field. What would be a day in one place might be a billion years in another. He does not describe exactly how this difference would work out during the 6 days of creation. By the way, later he did, which was one of his big mistakes, right? But his suggested resolution of disparity of timescales at least indicates that there can be a solution. This, to me, is the value of Schroeder. I might note here that according to modern cosmological theory, this is the unbiased reviewer of him, there can indeed be places in the universe whose timescale differs from our own by a factor of a billion years. It is not fantasy or science fiction. And then he ends off with this. I do not know, nor does Schroeder profess to know, whether his suggestion for the resolution of time discrepancy is correct, but I suggest this kind of explanation might lead to one. I think the ultimate resolution will show the Torah account to be correct within the proper context. Following the text in a natural manner without arbitrary redefinitions and convoluted explanations, which is what those other guys were doing. The bottom line is, to say that God is capable of incorporating all of Einstein's theories in a practical sense into his creation is really not much of a stretch. And I would think that the service that Schroeder has done is he said that it's too simplistic to just evaluate this issue from a Newtonian perspective, and one has to take into account the fact that Einstein revolutionized the understanding of time itself. Time itself now is such a difficult parameter to work with that I don't know if Schroeder's got it exactly, but one can feel satisfaction in knowing that it's even conceivable to have 7 days pass at the very same time as 13 billion years. Those two things can happen simultaneously. That is accepted by the entire scientific community. And if it is true, we just have to figure out the details and exactly how it works out. But I think that it's a great source of satisfaction. Could be that it gives you an insight into the greatness of the Borei in the fact that this is the way his universe operates.
Who came up first with the Kiddushin, Rabbi Schwab or Schroeder?
They're saying different things, but Rabbi Schwab sort of gives a general kind of overview that you could fit Schroeder into as the explanation for what he's talking about.
Scientific.
Rabbi Schwab wrote his thing in the 60s.
Also, why would we say the 7 days in Bereshit?
What?
The 7 days in Bereshit is talking about God's terms.
Yes. He's talking about our terms, but he's describing the flow of time from his perspective.
Why is the Torah supposed to be on human terms?
It is human terms. Day is a human term. Time is human terms. God doesn't need to deal with time. So he's saying, from my perspective, in your terms, 6 24-hour periods passed.
From God's perspective.
In other words, from that vantage point, time, the flow of time is such that it was only 6 24-hour periods that passed.
And this also,
whatever that means from his perspective, granted. But from another perspective, the one we're used to, yeah, of course 13 billion years have passed. Which is why all our discoveries are pointing to that fact. Right? All our measurements lead that. Because from our time perspective, that's the amount of time that's passed. But from another perspective, right? If you could just sink your teeth around, and believe me, I'm far from able to do it myself, what time dilation really means, it's a very hard thing for us to grasp.
Exactly.
I'm telling you at the very same time, the time's flowing at different rates. It's an amazing idea. It's true. It's been proven. It's absolutely true. So once you say that, all bets are off on this whole time.
So now, I don't know what 13 billion years means.